Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Restaurants are startups. Why don't more of them get funded by venture funding? Find out on today's episode of Tech Bites. Hello, hello, Heritage Radio Network listeners. Happy 2018. This is the very first episode of Tech Bites for the year. It is January 18th, 2018, and we are live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, inside two shipping containers that are the Heritage Radio Network studios. We broadcast from Roberta's Pizza, which is a great place to be on a 25-degree, cold, brisk, wintry morning. I'm excited to start this year off. I'm excited to have our guest with us today, Charlie O'Donnell, who's the founder and partner of Brooklyn Bridge Ventures.
Happy to be here.
I'm also happy to be talking to our listeners from 150 countries around the world. That's about a million listens a month. Things are looking really great for 2018, and I'm excited. We are going to start off today's episode, like we always do, talking about apps. Apps for the new year, maybe old ones that you just keep and hang on to since you've had your phone 10 years ago. We'll start off with David Tatasciore, who is our engineer and Heritage Radio Network's studio manager. David, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Good to be back, even though I'm not quite 100%, but getting there.
If you had a battery percentage over your head, what would it say?
I'll say 86.
So you're okay. 86 is good.
Yeah, it's decent.
It's decent. You don't need to be plugged in, and I would take you on the subway.
Oh, thank you.
How was your holiday break?
It was great. I did a little bit of traveling, which actually segues nicely into my app that I got a lot of use out of. And it's been mentioned on the show before, but Signal was invaluable for me in other countries to communicate with my friends and not use mobile data. I didn't like bother setting up a mobile plan just because it wasn't really necessary. I was able to get on Wi-Fi in most places, so Signal was great to stay in touch.
And you were traveling internationally, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
The Wi-Fi, the free Wi-Fi messaging apps are great for international travel.
Yeah. Yeah, and that way I didn't have to dip into the Travel Pass or whatever that Verizon offers. It's actually a pretty affordable thing, but I just decided not to bother.
I usually put my phone on airplane mode when I get on the plane and then don't take it off until I land
back
at the airport. And then I just use Wi-Fi. I also like WhatsApp, which is a similar.
Yeah, I was kind of forced to get WhatsApp by one group of friends that I was traveling with because that was what they used. But WhatsApp is owned by Facebook, so I wasn't keen on using them.
Well, good point. Fair point. Follow your convictions all through to your app usage.
Yeah, Signal all the way.
Okay. Charlie, do you have an app that you like right now? And the only rule is that you're not allowed to talk about an app that you've invented, own, or invest in.
Sure. Well, not to play into something that's usually overhyped, but I do find myself checking the Coinbase app on a regular basis because everything going on in the Bitcoin and Ethereum and all that world is very exciting, and more exciting because it crashes and surges every day, and so it's a little bit like a roller coaster to be involved in that a little bit.
Is it, I get the sense that it's almost like watching a currency child grow up in many ways because it's so new and it's so unpredictable. And it sort of grows in leaps and bounds and then regresses and has tantrums and is kind of crazy and nobody really understands what it's saying. But it has a lot of value and a lot of potential.
I think a lot of people are hoping it has a lot of potential. I'm not quite there yet. I'm trying to trade off of the ups and downs and doing an okay job of it. But it's not for the faint of heart.
Are you participating in it because it's current and it's interesting? Do you think it's a really viable financial investment? Is it just to stay current and find out what's happening? Is that the best way to understand something, to get involved in it?
I think there's some aspect of trying to follow it and stay current and have a little bit of a vested interest. But I think from a fund investor standpoint, I think a lot of aspects of it are very, very early. There's still a lot of regulation left to go on it. The SEC is taking a look at it, international regulators. And so despite the reputation of VCs going early on things, you don't want to go so early that you might make an investment in something that 2 months after you make an investment of it, the government declares it illegal or you know, you have to unwind it in a really messy way. And so you want some element of stable footing because, you know, you're trying to build companies that are going to be around for 5, 6, 7 years. And I don't think the ice flows are quite solidified on this yet to know where that's going. And I think some of the investors are just essentially backing smart teams. And they're just saying, okay, well, if I hold on to this team for a few years, they will be able to figure it out and be eyes wide open about it. But it's really hard to come up with a really stable, substantive business plan in that space.
Especially because it's so challenging to understand exactly what it is and how it works in many ways. It's very different from here's a pile of money or here's a weight of some valuable commodity that we can translate into a value or here's a thing that we're going to sell. It's so theoretical. Sometimes I think it's even harder to wrap your head around it even is.
The actual instruments are fairly technical. When you get into it and you find the rare person that can actually sit down and explain it to you, which given how few people there are, yet so many people that are invested in it, it is sort of troubling. It's not that bad, but I think there's a lot of pieces that just aren't quite there yet for even institutional investors, let alone the average person, to be going in a major way. So, you know, you read stories of people taking money off of their credit cards to invest in Bitcoin. That is not something that any individual should be doing. And you just assume you're going to lose all of it. Yeah.
TechBytes public service announcement. I'll be waiting for the Bitcoin for Dummies book to come out.
There you go. That's probably a good start.
Which will explain it to everyone. My favorite stories are the ones about, you know, the college kids who start mining in their dorm rooms and, you know, that kind of thing. I like those stories.
You know, it's funny. You could do that early on, and now the speed at which information travels and things become professionalized and money flows, right? Like, there was a period of time where you could make money doing that, and now you've got hedge funds piling, you know, there's a lot of money in the world and it seeks return and it seeks return very quickly. And that's why you get, you know, bubbles in real estate and bubbles in other stuff. And so it's like almost as soon as the average person's making money on something, some bigger pool of money comes and ruins
it. Gobbles it up.
Yeah.
Well, my app this week is called Think Dirty Shop Clean. And it's not quite a new one. It's been around since 2013, but it's a new one for me. I recently discovered it. We talk so much on Tech Bytes and on Heritage Radio Network and in the media about the food we eat and where it comes from. And everybody talks about clean eating and organic. We talk about creating an environment that's clean. But we don't talk quite as much about what you put on your body as much as you put in your body. So makeup, cosmetics, you know, healthcare, laundry detergent, all those kinds of things. That's another one of those segments where people are becoming more and more curious and concerned and conscientious about what they put on themselves. So Think Dirty is a fun app you scan the barcode of a product or search a product, and it gives you a list of the ingredients. And then based on the list of the ingredients, it gives you a ranking on how clean or dirty or carcinogenic it is. It also provides a little shopping environment. If you want to look at some all-natural products, it'll link you out to Amazon or other sources. It will also just show listings of different things. And I think it's a lot of fun. It's the kind of thing where I could see myself, you know, spending 2 hours in the drugstore just sort of like scanning all these different things that I want to buy. Because I do think it's kind of it's kind of counterproductive if you spend so much time and attention to, you know, eat wonderfully produced chemical-free things, but then you just sort of slather on, you know, terrible things on the outside. It is crowdsourced a little bit, the information. They have about 350,000 products now. A lot of my Korean beauty products weren't listed, but they ask you to, if you scan the barcode and it's not in their database, they ask you to take a picture of the front and back of the product and send it to them, and then they will presumably go through the process of adding it to their database and vetting it and all of that. So it's a fun product. It started by a woman in Canada whose mother had a bout with cancer, and then that sort of drove her desire to take a look at what was in cosmetics and health products. And interestingly, that category is not really FDA regulated, so you don't have the same checks and balances from the government entities to tell you that this is okay. You can kind of do what you want and put what you want on the box. So
I'm actually testing a safe deodorant at the moment. There's a startup that is doing some products in this space, and it is an aluminum-free, very, very carefully constructed deodorant that is safe for human beings. And so far, it seems like it's working, I hope.
Yes. Well, so far in the shipping container, it seems okay. Yeah. We're in a closed environment. We are quite far away from each other, and we're wearing big sweaters because it's very cold still. Yeah, so think dirty, shop clean. That's a fun one. It's for Android and iPhone, and of course, it's free. So we have Charlie here today. Again, Charlie O'Donnell. He's the founder and partner of Brooklyn Bridge Ventures, which is the first fund in Brooklyn. It's about $23 million across two funds. He likes to do seed investing, pre-product, sometimes pre-deck. And he has invested in some interesting food companies and food startups, one of them being Agrilist, which is virtual agronomist Allison Koff, who was on episode 106 of Tech Bites. She's fantastic.
And she's
super
really
smart.
Great.
Mm-hmm. Super smart. Super smart, but really a good communicator because she can explain it in a way that's engaging and not like agronomy for dummies.
For sure.
We had a great conversation before the show about why more restaurants and food products are not funded by venture capital. And it's an interesting question, and I think it's a relevant one. I've always thought of restaurants as being the original startup. You know, you have this idea, you get some crowdfunding together from friends and family, you know, round of investing, you come up with a product, you try it out, you try and get traction, you know, you grow. It really replicates a lot of the tech startups, but for some reason we don't see venture funding in restaurants. And why is that?
Well, it has happened. It happens rarely. And so, for example, P.F. Chang's is venture-backed, and Blue Bottle raised some venture money, but the vast majority don't. And you have to understand venture capital is a form of financing like anything else, right? So when somebody starts a business, they usually, the primary source of financing is their own savings, right? And they are the venture capitalists. They decide that they are worth the bet, and they're going to take their savings and put it into the down payment on their storefront and the oven and the materials and all that sort of stuff. And you know, for many people, that winds up being a very good bet. Different forms of financing come with different expectations on behalf of the person who's giving you money. So you take out a bank loan, they expect interest and a payment back at a certain time. If they don't get that, they'll they'll take that pizza oven or whatever they have that's sort of collateralizing it. Your friends and family might have a certain level of expectation. A venture capitalist is building a portfolio of, you know, 20 or 30 investments at a time. And they are really looking for the home run. They are looking for companies that have the ability to exit, to go public, or to sell to another company for, you know, anywhere from $250 million to billions of dollars, right? And so you're talking about the, you know, Facebooks and you know, Amazons and Ebays and all of those companies. Or, for example, in the food space, like a Shake Shack, or, you know, Blue Apron became a public company and Plated sold for $200 million. And so there are some food businesses that set their sights from day one on, you know, being able to achieve those kinds of outcomes. And that takes a lot of time. So you need patient capital. You need capital that is willing to take some bigger risks. And the capital is okay if it doesn't work out. I mean, my expectation in my fund is that 50% of the companies will probably go out of business and be zero return for me.
50%. That seems high to me.
That seems very high.
And very risky on your end.
It is very risky, but when a payoff happens, when, you know, that one or two companies in any fund goes public or sells for $500 million, the returns are 50x, 100x. And so the good ones make up for the ones that didn't make it. And for many entrepreneurs, you know, starting a business or starting a restaurant with that right out of the gate has a 50% chance of being literally an outright failure. I mean, some restaurants run for a few years and
they
decide to not do it anymore. But that's maybe riskier capital than they want someone pushing them to make choices around.
So many interesting things that you just said, sort of describing the process and the philosophy and some of the ideas behind venture funding. When people typically, when people start a food business or a restaurant business, a food product, most of the, you know, spreadsheets and proposals and things that they're looking at in terms of how the business will open and run and finance itself, they're looking at things in the 18 months to maybe 5-year range. They're looking at, you know, maybe being able to pay investments back in, you know, 18, 24, 3 years, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. The margins are extremely low. I don't know that I've ever seen or heard of a restaurant or food product proposal that had something where they could get to that number so quickly, where they could get to a number of $250 million in sales or revenue in a 5-year period of time.
Well, it'll usually be something along the lines of probably like $100 million. So mm-hmm. a $250 million might be the price at which someone might purchase that business if it's growing, right? And if it's growing very fast, you might get 1.5 times revenues or 2 times revenues. So most of the proposals you want to see going up to, let's call it 100. Not that that's really much easier.
It's still pretty hard. I mean, it might as well be half a billion.
Sure, exactly, right? And, you know, some of those time periods are longer. They could be, you know, 7-8 years down the line. But you're right. I mean, you're talking about experiencing significant growth. And from the perspective of, you know, a food business that takes place in four walls, you're talking about multiple locations, and you're talking about multiple locations being opened up per year, right?
And so almost simultaneously.
Yeah, absolutely. And for many restaurateurs, you know, to even think about a second location usually is after that period of paying back
when it's
their initial investors,
and you
right?
don't have any more, you have smaller debt, or you have mm-hmm. a bona fide, strong concept with a audience and, you know, customers who are interested and loyal to the brand and for buzz sure. and all those kinds of things.
I mean, Shake Shack is a good example. Shake Shack was the one solo location in Madison Square Park for, I'm going to say maybe 3 or 4 years before they opened up a second location. It was
It was a hot dog cart first.
It was a
hot dog cart in the park that they pushed out of the front doors of 11 Madison. 11
Madison,
park.
Yeah.
I want to say it was even maybe 10 years ago. A long time ago, it was a part of pre-Madison Park sort of refurbishment.
Yes.
And that was a part of how they were starting to raise, you know, funds and create, you know, some different kind of community touch points within the mm-hmm. park. And so it literally started off as a hot dog cart.
For sure. And now you've got companies like, I think I heard that Sweetgreen is opening up a location a week or every other week this year.
So 50 Sweetgreens.
25 to 50 Sweetgreens this year.
Coming out in 2018.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what is the, what do you think the principal barriers are for restaurant and food products to even get to that way of thinking? Is it because you come from finance in a world where you're talking about big numbers and these types of things are just par for the course, and so it's a natural scale to be thinking about? Is it because people are making food one dish at a time and it's hard to even get there? Is it just because the numbers are so scary in the restaurant world that nobody wants to take that much risk?
I think it's a couple of reasons. I think driving to that scale, I think, requires a certain amount of people infrastructure, right? To be able to open up multiple facilities a year requires a team whose job it is to only do that. It requires a team to train, and it requires, you know, marketing and branding that's over and above just, you know, a sign outside your front door. And it's an infrastructure that many people who know how to make great food, it's just two totally different skill sets, right? Just, you could make the greatest pizza in the world, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you are an expert on, you know, real estate finance or contract negotiation or any of that. So I think one of the primary skills that you need as an entrepreneur is a team builder. And building for these kinds of teams, I mean, first of all, there are really only a handful of examples of people who were present for the beginning stages of a multi-unit chain that's sort of in this generation that was sort of skyrocketed, right? Because when we think of, you know, the big chains, right, they've been around for a long time. And so you're really pulling from only a handful of people that even have that experience. I think as you see that happen more and more, much like in the tech world, PayPal threw off a bunch of new entrepreneurs who had that, you know, experience. I'm sure you will see former, you know, Shake Shack employees go off and start their own businesses. I'm sure hopefully one day we'll see former Ample Hills employees, after experiencing that rocket ship, go off and do those new things. So being present for that, I think, gives people the experience necessary. And I also think the financing side. There are very few investors who hold themselves out to want to invest at this stage in ideas that plan to be national and plan to be national within four walls type businesses. And so if you don't know those people and talk to them, like, it wouldn't even occur to you that anyone would fund you to do that kind of plan. So you have to be sort of in those kinds of environments to think that that's even possible.
Financing, very, very important to all kinds of businesses and equally important to Heritage Radio Network. We are a 501c3 nonprofit. We are completely member and sponsor supported. And we are going to take a quick break right now to find out who the amazing people are who are helping us keep the lights on and the mics hot. Stay with us.
Heritage Foods USA is a farm-to-table online butcher and founding sponsor of Heritage Radio Network.
Heritage Foods got its start when Patrick Martin's first stepped foot onto Frank Reese's Kansas farm in 2001. Back then, Frank was the only farmer in America raising true heritage turkeys with recorded lineages tracing back more than 150 years.
Patrick knew instantly he'd found a unique moment, an opportunity to go beyond acknowledging these breeds as being jeopardized and to actually do something to save them. Patrick asked Frank to ramp up production and made a promise to him that if he would raise them, Heritage Foods USA would sell them.
That was the moment that Heritage Foods' slogan, "Eat 'em to save 'em," was born. By creating a market for delicious meats from heritage breeds, we can ensure they'll be around for generations to come.
Plus, heritage breeds just taste a whole lot better. Learn more at heritagefoodsusa.com and use the code HERITAGERADIO for 2 free pork chops with your first order, brother.
Well, if you're just joining us and you're wondering what the hell you clicked on, this is Tech Bites, the weekly show where we talk to innovators and influencers in the food tech space. And today we are talking with Charlie O'Donnell, founder and partner of Brooklyn Bridge Ventures, the first venture fund in Brooklyn. If you want to follow his business, and he writes quite a bit and blogs and has events, you can follow him on social media at CEO NYC. You can follow the business at BBDOTVC, or check out the website brooklynbridge.vc. We're talking right now about why is it that more food and restaurant businesses aren't funded by venture money, and it kind of comes down to, I think, scalability and also it just being so different from the way people run businesses. I do think that sometimes it's hard enough to even imagine saying a word like, I'm going to grow my business revenue to $100 million a year, let alone being able to figure out a way to ladder up to that. So one of the things that we talked about just before the break was, Charlie makes the interesting point that staffing a business and hiring a team around your business is perhaps the first most crucial step to figuring out how to get there. So if you're a person who's starting a food business or has a restaurant, and obviously your main concern is making delicious product, and his fund group has invested in Ample Hills Creamery, which is a good example to talk about because they do one thing. They do ice cream.
They do it really well.
You have to go in real life to an Ample Hills Creamery ice cream shop to have it.
You can order it online now.
Oh, you can order it online now. Okay. Exciting. But that is not something, if you put down, you know, 5 businesses on the table and said, pick the one that you think is venture ready, I would not have guessed the ice cream shop.
It is the company that most people wind up asking about when they're curious about Brooklyn Bridge Ventures. And I would put forth that Ample Hills is a brand that has the potential for national reach. And there are a fair number of higher-end ice cream brands, and many of them are very urban. They are artisanal in the sort of style and flavorings. There's, they're experimental. They're interesting. You can go out and get, you know, lavender ice cream or Earl Grey ice cream or you know, blue
smoky
cheese.
Smoky bacon, fennel ice cream from a truck frozen with liquid nitrogen.
Exactly. And you know what? Many of those are really, really fantastic, but I'm not sure they play in Des Moines. I'm not sure they play really across a wide variety of palates. And Ample Hills, to me, plays to 7-year-olds all across the country who like marshmallowy, gooey, chunky, you know, how many crazy things can you pour into to something?
And let's be fair to the 7-year-old
in all of us. Yeah, yes, in all exactly. Of us.
Yes,
exactly.
Because it's a lot of grown-ups standing in line at Shake Shack for the concretes and the shakes and all
sure,
of that.
Sure. And so I think with that in mind, when Brian and Jackie started the business, I think they knew that while it started in Brooklyn, it was not limited to Brooklyn. That, you know, their branding is not something where you say, oh, that's really Brooklyn. It's actually a very traditional, it's heavy on storytelling. They have characters.
I would call it the sort of very fashionable and hip old-timey branding.
It's a little old-timey, yeah. Yeah, for sure. But, you know, I think it reminds people of good dessert experiences, great dessert experience they had in their childhood at the, you know, the shop on Main Street. And that's one of the things, too, is, like, you go to an Ample Hills. They want you to come there. They have booths. They have a roof deck in their Gowanus location, and one of their new locations will also have that. And so I think they were conscious that it was that it could have national reach. There's a national example of that, right? Ben and Jerry's became a fairly large exit, and Ben and Jerry's is an inspiring company to anyone who's gotten inspired in the ice cream space.
And I think one that's on their current upward trajectory, and I don't think we know where they're going, is Big Gay Ice Cream.
Oh, sure.
You know, started in a truck. Now they have stores. Now they have pints in retail and a cookbook and all those kinds of things. And I don't think that, I think that, you know, is also a surprising current ice cream explosion story.
Oh, yeah. There's a fair number of them. But one of the things that also, I think, pushed them to think bigger is being in New York, there are some people here who have a fair amount of money, and they got inbound from an investor, and it wasn't me.
So they open the ice cream shop. It's doing really well. Mm-hmm. They have a great product, a great experience. Mm-hmm. They themselves were not necessarily thinking funding an expansion. They had an investor come to them and say, this is a great product. Have you thought of expanding?
Yeah, I think they had some near-term needs. Mm-hmm. They knew that just making ice cream in their shops was a very expensive way to make ice cream.
Limiting also in terms of volume.
In terms of volume. I think they thought they had something that was good enough to be on shelves in other places, but there was sort of a gap of how do we get from here to there? And, you know, they explored bank loans and all that sort of stuff. And you know, banks aren't the most risk-taking of investors. And somebody came to them and made an offer, and, you know, much like a lot of food and beverage entrepreneurs deal with, it was a little bit of a Shark Tank offer. It was a little bit of like, here's this amount of money that's more money than you've really ever thought of, but for a very large chunk of your business. And that was a very difficult problem, and they were considering it, and somebody recommended to them that they talked to me about this, because literally my office was two blocks away and I was in there all the time. And I sat down with them and said, well, you know, I think I can help you plan this out. And oh, by the way, you know, the kinds of things we're thinking about are, how do you not run out of money? Who do you hire? What should your goals be? These are all the same questions that all of the tech companies that I invest in are going after. And then I kind of got there on the investment. I said, well, actually, I think these national aspirations could produce the kinds of returns that my investors would be very happy with.
Tech startups have been such a cultural business phenomenon of the last, I would say, 10 years. They're relatively new, but very, very quickly with the accelerators and the incubators and, you know, sort of reading about it in the news, it very quickly fell into a very specific protocol and path to sort of launch and success. Mm-hmm. You can find online any number of websites where you can look at decks and videos, and somebody will walk you through what you need. On your blog, there's a great mm-hmm. video of what to put in your pitch deck. So for the tech entrepreneur or the startup entrepreneur, there are a lot of templates and roadmaps that are well established, I think, to follow to take people through the thought process, the building process, to get to that, you know, six-figure exit deal, seven-figure exit deal, 8, 9, 10. Restaurants don't have that, though. I don't think when you think about, you know, sitting down and I'm going to start a food business, there are no similar resources of what does my proposal look like? What does my pitch look like? I don't even think restaurant and food people think about launching a business in terms of a pitch? Could restaurants and food people simply pick up some of those startup resources, utilities, frameworks, and sort of follow that path? Do they need to adjust because it is food?
Yeah, I think...
Should somebody start a restaurant incubator?
You've really hit upon a real pain point, and not just in food and bev, but quote-unquote small business or local business in general. I think you have local and neighborhood examples of success, but you know the popular restaurant in your neighborhood, that founder's not blogging. Right, they're not sharing, you know, exactly, you know, how they got there and the mistakes that they made, and I think that's a missed opportunity for chambers of commerce and local, you know, city agencies or whatever to connect small business owners who are starting out with one unit with best practices. I think you know that would be incredibly helpful. There are starting to become some food incubators. There's one called FoodX. Chobani has set up an incubator mm-hmm. for food businesses, and so you're starting to see some of the people take that startup and tech model and apply it to these types of businesses in small ways. But it does need some adjustment. You know, food and beverage investors don't necessarily look for the same types of things that tech investors do. I mean, there's a little bit of overlap here and there, but your story is going to be crafted in a little different way. And one of the key things, for example, in the food, you know, the sort of more CPG side of food is that distribution is obviously really key, right? And we think about in tech of like, oh, you just build an app and put it on the app store and you don't need to like, you know, maybe...
Exactly, and you get downloads.
And you just get downloads, right?
Count downloads and clicks and likes and how many Instagram followers you have.
It doesn't quite work that way on the Whole Foods shelves.
You can't go from, you know, selling 20 pizzas a day to selling 200,000 pizzas a day right. overnight.
No, you that just, would be incredibly difficult.
You can't support that.
Yeah. And so it is a little bit of a different track, but I also think that who is starting some of the food businesses today is changing. And, you know, these entrepreneurs are more tech savvy, more social media savvy. So the networking that happens on social media, the connectedness of those founders, I think is changing a little bit. And so you're seeing more collaboration, more, you know, so for example, I mean, Ample Hills worked with Baked by Melissa to come up with a really terrific Summer of Love ice cream flavor last year. And it was one of my favorite flavors that they've ever done. And, you know, so that type of thing is happening more and more. You know, Roberta's will show up at Three's Brewery and on their rotation. So you're seeing a lot more collaboration, I think.
So one of the other things that we talked about, and you know, sort of using the technology and connectedness of social media and blogging, is a good segue into something else that we talked about prior to the show, was there is so much technology available now to people, to businesses in life that, you know, similar to what you're talking about now, that most restaurant and food people are not really tapping into the power of social media, community, and connectivity. Mm-hmm. What are some of the, you know, your top line tech services that you think restaurants and food companies are really missing out on the benefits and the efficiencies of?
Well, I think you're seeing a lot of financial infrastructure tools pop up on the restaurant side, right? And so there's some basics that people know they have to get, right? There's going to be a cash register app and, you know, depending on, there's a whole slew of them that they can sort of pick. But, you know, on the marketing and branding side, I think that's an area where there's a real opportunity to sort of tell your story, drive people into your business. And, you know, restaurants are sort of familiar with the Seamlesses and the Yelps of the world. But in terms of brand building, I think there's an opportunity there. I mean, we talked about video is one where there are some really compelling stories of how people got started or family members that are involved in different businesses that would make for really compelling video content. And video content gets a fair amount of engagement on Facebook and Instagram or whatever. But people think of it as sort of very expensive. You have to bring a camera crew in and editing and whatever. I've backed a company called OpenReel. And OpenReel is a remote tool that enables you to sit down with your own phone and have a director essentially walk you through a video shoot and be able to produce 2, 3, 4 videos, depending on how quickly you can get through them, in an hour period for a fraction of the cost of having a crew come in and do it. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that somebody sees a video, somebody sees a story that might touch off a news article, a review, or just let people in your neighborhood know why you started this business in the first place. And it's a lot easier, I think, than people can think.
Social media, marketing, brand building, those are things that my guess is a lot of restaurants and food companies think about as important but not a fundamental piece of the business when they're building their business and planning for it. And I think this perhaps goes back to what you were saying earlier about building a team of people who have the vision for all the different business channels that you need to grow a business to that level. You know, when you think about a tech company or a tech product or even a business company, most people would never think of opening a business to scale nationally and not have some marketing department mm-hmm. or PR department or a director of marketing and social media advertising to be channeling all of that. That would be a significant, C-suite position. Most people would have a slot for it. You know, you'd have the CEO founder, you'd have finance, you'd have operations, you'd have human resources, and you'd probably have marketing. Those are probably the big five, sure. Right? Restaurants don't think about that, I don't think. And I don't think food companies do necessarily. I think, it's chef, manager, beverage person,
pay the rent,
HR person, accountant. And then all of those things become these sort of add-ons of, do we have the money to pay a publicist? Do we have the money to pay a marketing person? Do you think that it's important if restaurants really want to scale at that level, when they sit down and they think about their business plan, that they scope their business and staffing like a non-food business?
No, I 100% agree. And I think one of the ways they can do that is, one of the benefits of getting an investor is that an investor might join your board and bring with them the discipline of having a board meeting, mm-hmm. right? Just even sitting down and saying, what are we going to do this month? What did we try and do last month? Did it work? Did it not work? I would recommend any business, food, restaurant, create a little board for yourself. Find some people who will sit down with you, 2 or 3 people, and ask you questions and hold you accountable so you can walk through the list that you just said. What are we doing for marketing? Now, it's maybe not realistic to hire a marketing person, but it's certainly realistic for the founders of a restaurant on a monthly basis to just sit down for a half hour, hour, and say, how are we going to drive people into the business this month? How are we going to carve out time? What can we think about ahead of time creatively? What's coming around the calendar? What events and all that sort of stuff? And I think just dedicating some time, even if you don't necessarily have the resources to actually planning things, because otherwise you're just playing whack-a-mole with your business and you're just waiting for that next pipe to burst or delivery not to come on time, and you're just catching things as they come and you're never really getting on top of your business and pushing it forward.
Great, great advice. And I'm sorry to say that we are out of time for this episode of Tech Bites. And I know that Charlie and I could keep talking probably well into, the end of the day's programming schedule. If you want to hear more from Charlie, you can go to brooklynbridge.vc online. You can also follow him on social media at CEO NYC or at BBOT. TVC. If you want to see him in real life and you want to have him listen to your startup idea and give you some feedback, go to his website and look for a series of events that he's doing called This Is Going to Be Big. That's his blog, and he will be doing a series of events in January and February called Fix Your Startup, Pitch for Good, where he's going to listen to 8 startups at each event and give you the short answer of what he thinks about it. If you want to hear more from me, I will be hosting a panel on tech and food at General Assembly next week on Thursday, January 25th at 6:30 p.m. We'll have a bunch of founders and CEOs of food tech talking about how you can get your startup off the ground in 2018. We will post information on all these things on TechBytes social media. You can find us at TechBytesHRN on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can email us, techbytes@heritageradionetwork.org. And you can find us on iTunes and Stitcher Radio to subscribe, download, and leave amazing 5-star reviews. I'm Jennifer Leuzzi. Thank you for listening to this first episode in 2018 of Tech Bytes with our guest Charlie O'Donnell from Brooklyn Bridge Ventures. Come back and see us again on Thursday next week at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.